big changes in Cuba.
Fidel was really a remarkable person. You can love him, you can hate him, but we all agree that he was one of the most important figures of the last century. His most remarkable ability was this. We walk down the street, we go about our business, we go about our lives, and we care about other people, mainly we're self-centered. And then we see a kid drowning in a river, and we forget everything, and we run and we save the person, and we bring the kid back to shore. And then we go about our business again as usual. Well, Fidel had the remarkable ability to get masses and masses of people to jump in the river every day. And that's now gone. Nobody else has that ability. And I think even Fidel understands that. So now we have a leadership that has to find another way to motivate their people in their country. It cannot be just ideological. And so they're instituting much more economic incentives. They have to, because they can't keep moving people without Fidel there as they used to.
That's Reuters journalist Mark Frank. We talk with him about his book, Cuban Revelations, Behind the Scenes in Havana. And the U.S. is stepping back from half a century of failed policy in Cuba. Will it take that long for us to correct our mistakes in the Middle East? We talk with foreign policy expert and Iraq War veteran Matthew Ho. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thanks for joining us. In October, when Mark Frank and I spoke about his book, Cuban Revelations, neither of us knew that in 2 months, the 54-year break in diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba would be coming to an end. Our conversation was about the profound changes in Cuba that have made the current developments possible, at least in part. Those changes are the focus of his book, Cuban Revelations. Frank is possibly the best-positioned U.S. journalist to report on those changes. Arriving on the island more than 20 years ago, he's considered by many Cuba watchers around the world to be one of the most informed English-language foreign correspondents working in Cuba today. He works for the news agency Thomson Reuters. Cuban Revelations is an in-depth look at the profound transformation Cuba has been undergoing as it moves from a strictly state-owned economy to one that mixes state and private ownership. The change has mirrored the change in Cuba's leadership from Fidel Castro to his brother Raúl. But Frank says those changes don't represent a rejection of Fidel so much as a realistic assessment of changing conditions, changes that really began with the fall of the Soviet Union when the Cuban economy went into free fall and the so-called special period began. I visited Cuba twice during the heyday of the revolution, before the special period. As part of a solidarity mission called the Venceremos Brigade, I cut sugarcane in the 1970 sugar harvest, working alongside Fidel himself for a morning when he came and visited our camp. It was quite an experience. The Cubans I met were fiercely proud of their country and affectionate toward Fidel. But the special period and the continuation of the U.S. embargo made it clear that Cuba would have to change. Some of those changes involve an increasing role for private enterprise. Others involve a commitment to a greener, lower-carbon economy. Through it all, the resilience of the Cuban people and their leadership have enabled the revolution to survive. How that happened is the core of Mark Frank's book, Cuban Revelations. It provides important clues as the world speculates on Cuba's future, now that a new era has begun. Mark Frank, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Pleasure.
Now, you've been living in Cuba since 1995. You married a Cuban woman, and you've been covering the country for Thomson Reuters and other publications. You say in your book, Cuban Revelations, that covering Cuba is really hard. Why?
Well, because it's very secretive, somewhat for good reason. There's very little access to official sources, so you have to really, you know, use your imagination and do a lot of legwork if you want a good story. Covering Cuba is like investigative journalism versus kind of just being handed something to copy and put out as a story. It takes a lot of footwork, it takes a lot of looking around in corners, a lot of source work, because nothing's just handed to you. You're not given a press release and then you just kind of copy it or put it out, and there's very few press conferences, et cetera. And, of course, everybody's, you know, a bit nervous about talking to you, not because they're particularly scared necessarily of the Cuban authorities, but because there's this atmosphere that anything that might be said could be taken advantage of by the United States or whatever.
And you actually got into a little trouble with Fidel at one point. Is that right?
Yes, I did. Well, we all have our moments, and Fidel got kind of mad at me for basically I got a hold of an internal document, a transcript of a meeting he held with the sugar industry, and he was kind of upset that I had seen it.
On page 15 of this book, and it's a really wonderful book, I have to say, I think it's one of the best written about Cuba. On page 15, you list the reasons why there has been no youth-led revolt in Cuba against the government. A lot of people say, well, how come there's been no Cuban Spring? Notable on the list are, it's easy to emigrate, there's good health care and education for all, the police and military don't brutalize the population, the leaders are not corrupt, the government has launched some significant reforms, everybody gets rice and beans, women are relatively liberated, and you're allowed to drink, party, and have sex out of wedlock. Now, that's quite a broad list. Cuba doesn't sound like such a bad place to live.
Well, I'm not saying it's either a good place or a bad place. I'm just saying it's very, very different from the Arab world. And to just, you know, blanketly say that something similar is going to happen in Cuba is just basically shows a lack of understanding of the country. There's plenty of problems in Cuba. That list includes that there's no internet. That list includes a number of things. But overall, the situation is very, very different. And so it's remiss to think that they're going to do something similar to countries that are, that, you know, the Arab Spring took place when wheat prices skyrocketed because most poor people in those countries eat bread. And so they were very hard-pressed while in Cuba. Like I said, everybody gets their rice and beans. So there's just so many differences. In the Arab world, one of the biggest problems is that there's lots of young people, and they have no place to go and nothing to do. In Cuba, there's not enough young people, and they have a place they can go. They can go to the United States, and unlike any other young person in the world, all they have to do is set foot in our territory, and they're welcomed and they become citizens. They're not considered illegal immigrants like everybody else. So all these things make a difference. And so it's remiss to just assume that what happens in another country is going to happen in Cuba just because it's autocratic or whatever you want to think about it. It's a very unique place.
Are young people leaving Cuba in droves, or is there just a steady trickle?
A lot of young people are leaving, and a lot of young people want to leave. They see it as a tremendous opportunity, as young people do all around the world. But again, unlike other people, it's very easy for them to enter the United States. And so, of course, many do decide to come to the United States. But no, the majority of young people in Cuba are not immigrating to the United States, but an important percentage are, and they tend to be intelligent and well-educated, and it's a loss for the country, without a doubt, and a gain for the United States.
Now, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, Havana entered what was called a special period. It was a period of a fair amount of privation. I mean, all of a sudden, they'd lost their energy supplies of oil. You arrived about 6 years after that.
Actually, just so you know, I actually arrived in 1993, not 95, so a few years. I arrived at the worst moment of the crisis.
So just 3 years. So you arrived about 3 years after that. What was the Cuba that you arrived in like?
It is very hard to explain because everything simply collapsed, not just materially, but psychologically, because they had believed in the Soviet Union. They had believed in that model. And all of a sudden, it vanished. And so this was very difficult for Cubans ideologically. And, of course, materially, it was much worse than the Great Depression here. Really, it was catastrophic. The statistics are similar to Poland after it was run over by both the Russians and the Germans in World War II. It was a disastrous situation. Really, really traumatic. There was no lights. There was no transportation. There was not enough food. You could go on and on and on. It was very, very difficult.
And how did the Cuban government deal with that? How did people survive that period?
You know, everybody always scratches their heads about Cubans because they somehow manage not only to survive everything, but to keep on dancing, singing, and running around with big smiles on their faces. So how did the Cubans survive? Well, you know, the Cuban government did a number of things. They created the dual economy, one part funded by dollars, one part, you know, the old currency, which basically had collapsed. So basically, they started a whole new economy called the emerging economy, which was made up of tourism, of you know, family for the first time being able to send money, of some small business, of foreign ventures, and this sort of thing, which was all a major concession for them at the time. So as this new economy built, you know, they used some of the profit from that to save the most important parts of the old system, which were free health care, free education, subsidized food, etc. And so they managed to get through this period, but very, very difficult, and they're still not over it. The average wage in Cuba is still, in real terms, about 20 or 30% of what it was before the crisis. Public transportation is still at about 20% of what it was before the crisis. So they've gotten over the worst of it. Certainly life is much, much better. The lights are on. There's lots of taxis. Everything else is much more food, much more small business. But it's still a very difficult situation, even now, 20 years after, which is why we are now going through so many interesting changes in Cuba. They have to change, and they've now really begun to change because they need to get out of this 20-year-long difficult situation that they're still in.
And we'll go more into some of those changes, but I'm curious about something. I remember hearing that during the, you know, the depth, if you want to say, of the special period of the privations, that because they did not have oil, they began to develop, you know, alternative ways, low-carbon ways of doing things, especially in agriculture, organic agriculture. I wonder if you could say something about that and have any of those ideas or ideas about sustainable ways to have an economy, more low-carbon ways to have an economy, have they continued, or are they, you know, now that they've discovered that there's vast quantities of oil off their shores, are they just throwing that all overboard?
No, quite the contrary. They are emphasizing alternative energy from windmill farms to solar energy to biogas. They're emphasizing this much more than ever before. Right now, about 3 to 4% of their energy is alternative energy, and they would like to have it up to 30 to 35% by the year 2025-2030. So they're emphasizing it more than ever. The urban gardens still exist, and now they're kind of also, they have something called suburban gardens, which kind of are rings of farms close to the cities, which are also organic and very low cost in terms of use of fuel. So I would say they're emphasizing it more now, not less.
You talked about the dual currency. I think probably most of our listeners have heard about that. Privileges people who have relatives in the United States, people who are able to work in the tourist economy, but disadvantages people who, you know, say work for the state, you know, who don't have access to that other currency. What impact did the dual currency have on class in Cuba, given that Cuba was really pushing to be an egalitarian society?
First of all, you know, they pretty much publicly announced that having a perfect egalitarian society is not their goal for the near to midterm future. So they've dumped that for a number of reasons. And now they would like to have a society where there are differences, but those differences are not, you know, super extreme like they might be in some other societies. So now they accept inequality within the country, though they don't really accept still the exploitation of masses of labor to achieve that inequality. So you want to start your own business, a small business, fine. You want to farm well and have a few farm workers, fine. You want to start a restaurant chain with, you know, 5,000 employees, not fine. So they've accepted some inequality, but, you know, with real limits still, and they keep those limits on, at least at the moment.
At least at the moment?
Yes, and in terms of, because you have to see in the future what happens, of course. And in terms of the hard currency or, you know, the dollar versus the peso, this, of course, created great inequality in Cuba because at the time they introduced the dollar, the peso was, the peso had gone from 5 to the dollar to 150 to the dollar. That's how bad the crisis was. Just in a couple of years, it had gone to that. So somebody who got $100 from a family member abroad every month was really fairly wealthy compared to a Cuban who was making maybe the equivalent of $2 or $3 a month. Now, today, that's still the case. You get $100. Well, the average Cuban makes $20 or $30 a month, so you're still doing much better. And of course, if you find a way to earn money, earn hard currency, you can still do quite well in Cuba without having a great deal of money. So there certainly is inequality. And because of that, you know, there many things are changing in Cuba. That they used to subsidize all services and all prices in exchange for people working for low wages. Now that's all changing, and they say they're not going to subsidize goods and services anymore. They're going to subsidize people, with the exception of healthcare and education. So, you know, electricity bills are now going to be on a sliding scale, water bills on a sliding scale, many things like that, because they feel they have to do this, and that's what they're doing. So what you're going to see in the future in Cuba is our differences. There already are differences, and they'll continue. But they're not on the scale, at least at this point, of other former socialist countries or market-oriented socialist countries. It's still not really okay to be a millionaire in Cuba, except if you're a famous artist or singer or something. But you can't make $1 million exploiting the labor of others. So they're still holding on to that concept that it's not ethical to, you know, make your fortune on the backs of other people, and we'll see for how long that's the case.
How do people, I mean, you're saying services are going to be billed on the basis of a sliding scale. That seems to be incredibly unwieldy, especially given that I would assume that there's a fair amount in the economy that's actually under the table.
Yeah, well, in terms of the electricity, it's not unwieldy. They have meters, and, the rate goes up, you know, so the first, you know, whatever 100 megawatts you use or whatever, it's very low cost and subsidized. The second is higher cost, and the third is higher cost. It's not really unwieldy at all. It's just a bill, and you pay it. In terms of underground economy, yeah, there's, you know, like most of Latin America, probably 30% of the economy is, you know, informal is how it's put, without a doubt. But this is not unusual.
Right. No, when you said sliding scale, I thought they were basing bills on people's income, but they're basing it on use.
Yeah. In terms of services, electricity, water, gas. Right now in Cuba, still the gas is basically for free and the water is basically for free because they're just putting in the meters now. So, you know, you run a small private restaurant, you get taxed high, but you don't pay anything to wash your dishes or cook your food. So, you know, this is still a work in progress, to say the least, but that's where they're moving towards.
So they're basically encouraging small entrepreneurship. What's your take on that? Does that mean that it's still the big state enterprises that are, you know, responsible for the kinds of industries that involve economies of scale?
Yeah, I mean, basically, at the last Communist Party Congress, they were fairly clear. They want to get out of all kind of secondary economic activity. They don't think that they've decided that the states should, you know, kind of regroup, focus on important stuff, and let, you know, the coffee shops go private, and the farming too. So, and this is because these services never worked very well, and the farming never worked very well, and they finally decided to try something else, which I think is very positive, having lived there for as long as I did. So, already in Havana, for example, the majority of eateries are in private hands when before they were all in state hands. Already in Havana and the adjoining provinces, when before the state controlled 90% of agriculture, now the majority of food is produced privately or by cooperatives. It's all transported privately, and it's all sold privately or by cooperatives. So, you know, they're moving important, you know, secondary areas at this point into the private sector. Same goes for, you know, room renting and this sort of bed and breakfast, this sort of thing. At the same time, the important companies, be it telecommunications, nickel, hotels. These are all still very much in state hands, and they say they will stay in state hands, though there'll be more joint ventures and more partnering with foreign companies.
So they plan to partner with foreign companies, not with Cuban entrepreneurs.
Exactly.
In this country, you get a fairly slanted view of Cuba, as I was well aware. I mean, I had one view of Cuba before I went, and this was, of course, a long time ago. But it was a more prosperous time because they were being propped up by the Soviet economy. And people were pretty positive about their country. They loved it. Everybody I met there was enthusiastic about, you know, wanting to tell me how great Cuba was. And when I came back to the United States, I could see with different eyes some of the problems with our country. So I just wanted to preface that. But nonetheless, now it's been a long time since then, some more than 30 years. And, you know, people have said that, yes, the government is allowing more entrepreneurship, but the taxes are extremely high on these small entrepreneurs, which makes it very difficult for them to operate. Is that true or not?
Well, you know, the fact is, in the United States, statistically, one out of every two small businesses fails within 5 years. And statistically, in Cuba, the rate is about 20% so far, 25%. There's over 1,700 private restaurants now. There's, you know, 24,000 private rooms. Everywhere you turn, there's people in private businesses. All the taxis are private. And you can go on and on. So, yes, it's difficult. And, yes, they have some things they still have to do. Most importantly, they have to provide a wholesale market for small business versus forcing them to go on the retail side. But it's not, you know, as untenable as it's presented, because the fact is there they are. There's like almost 500,000 people now in that sector, of which about 100,000 are employees, another 150,000, 200,000 are very tiny one-person operations, skilled trades, taxi drivers, and the rest are small businesses. So clearly, up to now, it's been growing. And clearly, up to now, the rate of failure is not as high as it is in Western countries.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Mark Frank about his book, Cuban Revelations, Behind the Scenes in Havana. So we've been talking about the current situation. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how we got here. The first thing that happened after, you know, the Soviet Union fell that kind of helped Cuba get a little bit more back on its feet was Hugo Chavez of Venezuela came, supplied oil, some liberalization began to happen. But Fidel Castro, who was still in power at the time, was unhappy with what he saw as an erosion of revolutionary ideals because of the kind of development of class differences as we, I don't know if you call them class differences, but certainly income inequality, as we've been talking about. And he launched something called the Battle of Ideas. What was that?
I think everybody's still trying to figure out exactly what it was. Basically, what he did is he kind of tried to go back to the early days of the revolution with the fervor of the youth. He reached out. He did two things. One, he started gathering tens of thousands of unemployed youth and putting them to work as social workers, art instructors, all kinds of things. And they began to mobilize university students, too. And basically, what they were doing is challenging the entrenched bureaucracy and the corruption within the bureaucracy. And the entrenched, you know, the increasing corruption that resulted from the very difficult times the country went through. But the way he did it was basically to have the young people take over all the gas stations, for example, and discover that 50% of the gas was being stolen. He didn't really institutionalize the change. It was just more of a movement. And, you know, it almost resembled the beginnings of the Cultural Revolution in China, which, you know, was disastrous in the sense of this kind of mobilization of young people against the system, because we've got to remember the system itself is made up mainly of Communist Party members. And so that was a battle of ideas in a nutshell. And, of course, as it was kind of in its highest moment, It came off of kind of the battle around Elian Gonzalez, and then by 1996 it become this big movement, kind of an alternative party and government in motion in Cuba, you know, an attempt to revolutionize the youth. And then Fidel got sick, and it just stopped. Simple as that. So it was very much something that Fidel orchestrated personally, almost against the government and almost against the party. And, of course, during that period, production fell, as it did in China.
It's interesting because one would think that Fidel might have learned from Mao's example. On the other hand, there seems something a little bit refreshing about a leader, you know, the leader of a country trying to stir things up from below, although he's actually stirring them up from the top, trying to stir up the below from the top. What's your take on this? Do you think it was, you know, something that was a complete mistake, or were there some good ideas that came out of that?
Well, first of all, you know, Cuba's a very tiny country. It's about the size of a Chinese fishing village. And that's important because what he did was not really it wasn't a power struggle. It wasn't a purge. It wasn't a front for some kind of internal battle in the political bureau. It was much more something very Fidel. Fidel is this quintessent revolutionary. He's always stuck by his ideals through thick and thin, and no matter what the consequences. And that's who he still is. As Raul Castro told the cardinal in Cuba, he's like a bulldozer. He just marches forward without looking too much at the dirt he piles up on either side. You know, he just goes forward with his basic values and beliefs. And he's doing that at the tender age of 88, which he is now. So that's just who Fidel Castro is. And that's one of the reasons he's as famous as he is. And so what he did was not really out of character for Fidel at all.
So he fell deathly ill. The battle of ideas stopped. People both within and outside of Cuba were preparing for his demise. I'd have to say in this country they were practically slavering at the prospect. What was the mood in Cuba at the time? Were people scared? What were they thinking?
Well, you know, first of all, everybody was very calm. And everybody went about their business. There was none of this kind of crisis that people expected when Fidel, you know, either died or left power. Everything was just completely normal. I think some people were nervous about the situation, but in general, you know, very quickly Raul took over, and there was a continuity there. So really, not much happened in terms of on the street. The dissidents did nothing, and the mass of people went about their business as usual. End of story. That's what happened. It was not a story, in a way, compared to what people expected.
Nonetheless, it was the end of his rule as a head of state. What was the status of the relationship between the government and the Cuban people at that time of transition? What were the people wanting? What were they ready for, and did they get it?
Well, it's complicated because, you know, probably luckily for the Cubans, Fidel is still around. Fidel wrote a reflection today in all the newspapers and all the media of Cuba talking about the heroism of people going to fight Ebola, the Cuban doctors who are going to fight Ebola in Africa, and comparing them to the soldiers who went and fought apartheid. So, you know, he's still there. And he's still putting out his things, even though he does not run Cuba anymore. So all these years later, he's still very much around. And that's a big difference from as if he had just disappeared. And then what happened is Raul took over, and there was a real very quick shift in the rhetoric and the behavior of the leadership. And this had to have been backed by Fidel. I think, you know, Fidel really couldn't let go of his project, but understood that when he wasn't around, it needed to be changed. The way I put it is this. Fidel was really a remarkable person. You can love him, you can hate him, but we all agree that he was one of the most important figures of the last century. And that's quite remarkable for a guy in a tiny country like Cuba. And for me, his most remarkable ability was this. We walk down the street, we go about our business, we go about our lives, and we care about other people, mainly we're self-centered. And then we see a kid drowning in a river, and we forget everything, and we run and we save the person, and we bring the kid back to shore. And then we go about our business again as usual. Well, Fidel had the remarkable ability to get masses and masses of people to jump in the river every day. And that's now gone. Nobody else has that ability. And I think even Fidel understands that. So now we have a leadership that has to find another way to motivate their people in their country. It cannot be just ideological, because nobody else has that ability, at least in Cuba at the moment. And so they're instituting much, much more economic incentives. They have to, because they can't keep moving people without Fidel there, as they used to.
Mark Frank. We'll talk more about his book, Cuban Revelations, after this cut from the classic Cuban album, Típico y Habanero. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Cuba-based journalist for Thomson Reuters, Mark Frank. Before the break, we were discussing the transition from Fidel to Raúl, from a more revolutionary ideological style of leadership to a leadership that's rolling up its sleeves to tackle economic reforms.
The style of leadership has totally changed. Raúl Castro projects a very different style than Fidel. He is discreet, not a showman, calm, not emotional, disciplined and into follow-up, not jumping from one project to the other, concrete versus abstract. They're very different. And while Fidel talked all the time, Raúl talks an hour or two every 6 months. He's a very different sort of leader.
Yeah, it sounds like he's a manager, which is probably something Cuba really needed.
Exactly, I agree, yeah.
And so when he took over from Fidel, Raúl Castro inaugurated a nationwide debate, that was in 2007, over the issues of reform. What were some of the key complaints of the population that emerged from that debate?
He orchestrated three grassroots economic discussions over a period of 4 years, and I attended many of them. In all three of those debates. And I also, as I show in the book, I got a hold of the internal guidelines for those debates, how the leaders of those discussions should act. And those guidelines were really clear that they should let people speak their minds 100%. And so, you know, they held these discussions and people spoke their minds. What did they say? One, they were very upset about being paid in one currency that was worth nothing and having to buy things in another currency that was worth, you know, much more. The dual currency, and that's now, of course, being eliminated. They were very upset by the bureaucracy and how it handled issues. The incredible amount of corruption and problems that exist in trying to get your daily needs taken care of. They were very upset about so much land being fallow and overrun by weeds and stuff at the same time that there wasn't enough food. They were very upset about the services, about state services, and about the poor quality of what was offered and the service. They were very upset about restrictions on their travel. They were very upset that they couldn't, you know, that they couldn't do certain things in their own country that foreigners could do. Young people were upset about not being able to have cell phones and internet. And you can go on and on. The Cubans complain all the time, trust me. They've always complained all the time. They just did it more openly in these meetings this time. But these gripes, you know, they always have griped, and they still gripe. And they should gripe, like everybody else. So you can go on and on. They had plenty of gripes.
And what was the response to them? How did Raul address their concerns, and have things improved? Well, you already said the dual currency is being eliminated. What, is he pegging the peso to the dollar? Is that how that's working?
Well, no. Well, first of all, the question is how much had Raul already thought about what he wanted to do and needed, you know, as a good organizer to get mass support for it, and how much did he really learn from those discussions about what the problems were, and we don't really know the answer to that. What we do know is that as Raul began to attack, do away with many old taboos and attack the bureaucracy and how Cuba was run from above, he very much needed support from below, kind of a pincer movement to try to deal with it, because it's a very difficult situation. And that he got. And so by the year, you know, by the year 2012, at the 2011-12 at the Party Congress, the party passed a 310-point reform plan, which basically covers everything these people complained about, though it won't resolve all the country's problems. And so, you know, since then, what? Well, they've lifted all these restrictions, right? You can go to hotels, you can have cell phones, you can travel freely. Cuba's the first communist country where dissidents are allowed to freely travel. They've, you know, basically leased out most of the fallow land, or a big part of the fallow land. They're turning over all these services to these, you know, eateries and all this type of thing to the private sector. So in many ways, they've met those initial demands. But even though they've met them and continue to meet them, of course, what happens in a system like Cuba is that it's not enough. That all these things are not necessarily going to change very much if other very important parts of that system aren't tackled. One is this whole dual currency that has to be eliminated to have better economy overall. Another is a need to attract foreign investment like all other countries. Another is a need to address the problems with centralized planning. And another is to address the state's monopoly on imports and exports. All these things now are beginning to be looked at, and I think at the next party Congress, they'll look much more seriously at them. So we're just in the very first phase of change in Cuba. This is not the end of change. This is the beginning of change, and we'll have to see how far it goes and where it goes. But he certainly listened, and certainly if you actually look at what the Cubans wanted and what he's doing, they're very similar.
So now, here's a big question. How has Cuba been able to survive and even thrive in spite of probably the longest boycott in world history by a world power that is just 90 miles from its shores? An unrelenting campaign of, you know, subversion. How has Cuba been able to do that?
Beats me. I really don't know. I mean, I think clearly, Fidel Castro's leadership had a lot to do with it. The Soviet Union had a lot to do with it. The Cuban people themselves had a lot to do with it. So, you know, it's a very complicated question. The fact is that they have managed to survive, and they still are managing to survive. You know, the Cubans are very adaptable. They went through 400 years of Spanish colonialism. They went through 50 years of U.S. neocolonialism. They've gone through hell and high water, and they've learned how to adapt and how to move quickly, et cetera, and how to function even in very difficult situations. So they're certainly not thriving right now. They're going through a very difficult time, and that's why they're making these changes. But there's no indication, as far as I'm concerned, that they're going to be falling, and that communism is going to fall in Cuba anytime soon. The revolution is over. I don't think this is actually true, at least at the moment. But, you know, again, you just have to wait and see. But the Cubans have shown one of the reasons that the Cubans have survived is that they're always underestimated. We think they're just going to sit passively by while we do whatever we do. And, of course, the Cuban government, at least, has always been incredibly proactive. They always strike back. They never just sit and take it. So, you know, while we increase sanctions, well, all of Latin America, you know, they've pulled off an amazing diplomatic coup in the region. After the revolution, only two countries recognized Cuba, Mexico and Canada, and the rest joined the U.S. effort to topple Castro. Today, every single country in the Western Hemisphere except for the United States, has normal relations with Cuba. And now Latin America is saying that they will not go to another summit with the United States unless Cuba is there. That's a tremendous diplomatic coup. So while we're beating them over the head on the one hand, they're very active on the other. And they don't sit back and take it. And I think that's a lot of why they've managed to survive.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, Mark Frank. Your book is Cuban Revelations, Behind the Scenes in Havana. I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for writing this book, which was really a terrific read.
Well, I really do appreciate it. Thank you.
Mark Frank has won various awards for his reporting on Cuba, including for his coverage of market-oriented reforms. Go to writersvoice.net for links to his most recent reporting since the opening of diplomatic relations with the U.S. Next up, we talk with Matthew Ho about torture and U.S. policy in Iraq and Afghanistan. A few weeks ago, we aired our interview with New York Times national security reporter James Risen about his book, Pay Any Price. One of the people he writes about who've paid a high price is my next guest, Matthew Ho. An Iraq War veteran and ex-Marine company commander, he suffered from combat-related PTSD so severe that he came close to suicide. After Iraq, he worked for the State Department in Afghanistan, but in 2009 he resigned his job in protest over U.S. strategic policy and goals in that country. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. I spoke with him just after the U.S. Senate's report on torture was released. I asked him what his reaction was when he heard about that report.
I think for most people it's not a surprise that we tortured. I think some people are shocked at the details. My personal experience with this was that in 2000, when I was in the Marine Corps, I attended our prisoner of war training. And during that training, we were subjected to many of the practices that were used against the detainees, including some of us, not me, but several of the men I went through training with were waterboarded. And I will tell you, it absolutely is torture. So what's shocking to me and what's disgusting to me is that for so long in this country, we have known very clearly through our experiences in war that torture does not work, that torture is ineffective, and very often it is counterproductive. And we've seen this in the torture report, that detainees gave false information. My question is that it took us 10 years to find Osama bin Laden. Was that 10 years partly because we were given false information because of torture, and we rejected other types of information? So what is so shocking to me and disgusting to me is that we did this torture. These acts were carried out in our names with the full knowledge that it doesn't work. And not only that, that it's illegal. We have laws against torture in this country. We are signatories to international treaties in this country, and this is illegal. And then on a better level as well is the inhumanity of this, the depravity of it, the sadism of it. I think one of the things most people weren't aware of was this notion of rectal feeding, where they mashed up the food of the prisoners and inserted the food via the rectum. And they did this to five prisoners. And there is no reason for that except sadism. So I think those three things there, the fact that we knew it was ineffective, it was U.S. government policy for decades that we didn't torture because it was ineffective. It was U.S. government law for decades that we don't torture. And then also, too, the sadistic aspects of it, the inhumanity of it, I think that's why I see this as not necessarily just the need for prosecution of the individuals involved, but also the need for reform of the intelligence services. Because if we have intelligence services that so willingly disregard and flaunt U.S. law, disregard experience and knowledge, and act in such a roguish and outlawish manner, then that is a real, real threat to American democracy.
And it almost seems like another example of the many that you have given in your work when you resigned in 2009 from the Foreign Service, you know, that our policies are not only ineffective, but actually lead to a worsening of conditions. Connect the parallels for us there.
Sure. You know, and this is something that goes back for decades again. You know, I mean, you can start in the Middle East with post-World War II and the coup we staged in Iran. We threw out their democratically elected government and put in the Shah and basically subjected the Iranian people to a police state, a terrible, sadistic, horrible police state for several decades until the Islamic Revolution in 1979 in Iran replaced the Shah's government with the Ayatollah's government. So I think that's instructive because you've seen U.S. policy, in particular in the Middle East, trying to manage things, trying to play one sect off against another, trying to control populations by utilizing a dictator or a despot, or by trying to foment revolution or dissent. And many times this is based along sectarian lines, along religious lines, along ethnic lines. And so you've seen this come full-blown in both Afghanistan and Iraq, where in both countries we supported one group against another group. In Iraq, after we overthrew Saddam Hussein, we supported the Shia at the expense of the Sunnis, and we created this civil war, a war that, along with our occupation, has left upwards of 1 million Iraqis dead over the last 11-plus years. In Afghanistan, we intervened in the middle of a civil war that was largely pitted along regional or ethnic lines. And we supported one side against the other, tried to play one side off against another, tried to pick winners and losers in a nation that we just clearly do not understand or have any interest in the average person there. We have our own geopolitical stakes in mind. So what you see here is you see this what's called blowback, where we invest our resources, our strategy, in this policy of trying to play one side off against the other, trying to utilize one group against another group, trying to control warfare. And anyone who's been involved with war, anyone who's studied history knows that war is inherently uncontrollable. And so what occurs then is then that you have this blow up. You have Frankenstein's created. Al-Qaeda, of course, is a perfect example of a Frankenstein. It comes out of our support for the Afghan Mujahideen, the Afghan resistance against the Soviets and the Afghan communists in the 1980s. We encouraged Arabs to travel to, primarily Arabs, but I should say Muslims really, to travel to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. And when that was finished, many of them remained and formed Al-Qaeda. In the same vein, too, with the Islamic State, you had no such organization, no such creature as Al-Qaeda or other group in Iraq prior to our invasion and occupation. And because of our invasion and occupation, these groups were created. And then we tried to utilize a group like the Islamic State to overthrow the government in Syria. And now it has just completely gotten out of control, and it is in the very best description of Frankenstein. So you see this happening over and over again, where we put foreign troops into a country, put foreign money into a country, and rather than having a pacifying effect, it encourages insurgency and it disturbs the population. Our foreign money does not help the people, but rather helps keep in place corrupt and predatory governments. So really, the policies we've had, Francesca, over the last decade, have brought us to this point where the Middle East is just incredibly, to say it's incredibly unstable is, of course, an understatement.
What should we have done in Afghanistan, for example, after 9/11?
Yeah, you know, this is a great thing to talk about, and it's a great learning point and very instructive. You know, after 9/11, we should have recognized that what was occurring in Afghanistan was a civil war. However, we put the events of 9/11 first in our perspective of Afghanistan, rather than ignoring the fact that, you know, Afghanistan has been in a state of war or at least political chaos since the mid-70s. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was I'm 41 years old, and if I had been born as an Afghan, I would never have known peace in my country. And we didn't have that perspective in 2001. We saw everything through the lens of 9/11. And so in our anger and in our rush for vengeance, we deposed one side in the Civil War and put the other side in power and didn't do anything to address the underlying political grievances, didn't do anything to address the causes of this war, which at that point was in its third, going to its fourth decade. So I think with Afghanistan, it's instructive for us to realize that these conflicts, we cannot conflate them with these small bands of terror groups. We cannot conflate them with these small bands of extremists. We have to understand these conflicts, these civil wars, as what they are. And we must seek to bring an end to them by negotiation, by trying to find a solution between the various groups, trying to find, bring about a ceasefire at first, but then try and bring about some type of settlement that brings about political order. Because if we go into the Middle East conflicts, if we venture into them and we decide we're going to pick one side against the other, well, then that other side we're up against now has its back against its wall, and it aligns themselves with Al-Qaeda. Or the population sees that group's propaganda is now valid. So in, say, Afghanistan's case, as we align ourselves with the warlords and the drug lords that ran Afghanistan before Taliban took over, as we put those people back into place, and as those people then go to prey, particularly on the pashtuns of the southeast of the country, well, then those people in the southeast of the country say, you know what, the Taliban are right. The Taliban are a national liberation army. Look, the Americans are here. They're supporting these very same warlords and drug lords that were raping and killing our people before the Taliban took power. Not that the Taliban were any better, but what it does is it shows how by our going into the conflict, trying to pick sides, it forces the other side to align itself with extremists. In the same way, too, in Iraq, when we invaded Iraq and occupied Iraq and we put the Shia in power and let the Shia persecute the Sunnis, well, then the Sunnis had no choice but to align themselves with Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was created. And now, as we see it again in Iraq, as we support the Shia government in Iraq, which is incredibly corrupt, very predatory, as we support the Kurdish government in northern Iraq, which has taken control of most of the oil fields, and the Kurdish government itself is by no means a democratic bastion of Jeffersons and Adams. It's very thuggish, very corrupt. Well, then the Sunnis then feel they have no choice but to align themselves with the Islamic State and support that group because they feel there's no alternative. So I think the lessons we need to take, Francisca, as we move forward is that we cannot be venturing into these civil wars expecting to pick one side against the other, expect to pick winners against losers, expect to control war and not have this blowback, not have the war become completely out of control, and not have the creations of these Frankensteins like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State.
Well, Matthew Ho, you know, I have just recently read a book about the position of women in Afghanistan and, you know, the fears that once we have now gone in there and made the situation worse, I think many people agree with your analysis of this, yet getting out doesn't seem to solve the problems either, that there's a resurgence of violence. I mean, is there anything that we can do to correct some of the mistakes we've made and to lead to some solutions?
You know, this is one of the problems we have, Francesca, is that when we make a decision that cuts off other avenues, then it's tough to go back to those avenues. And so in 2009, when I was stationed in Afghanistan, the insurgency, the Taliban, were coming to us and saying, look, we want to negotiate. We're tired of fighting. We've been fighting for decades now, but we're not going to surrender. And our line at that point was that they had to surrender. Our line was that they had to give up their weapons and embrace the Constitution, which basically meant surrender. I mean, there was no other viewing it other than that. And our administration, our policy was we flatly rejected any offers to talk. And then we simply lied about it. We claimed that the Taliban had no interest in negotiating, and that we had a military defeat, them. And so, of course, we surged in Afghanistan in 2009. And now, 5 years later, the situation is worse. Violence is much worse than it was 5 years ago. The Taliban is stronger. The government is more corrupt. The only thing that has done well in Afghanistan over the last 5 years, besides the Taliban gaining power, is the growth of the drug trade there. That every year there's record crops of poppies and record heroin exports. So I think the lesson is that if you move forward in such a manner where you are not going to reach out and talk to the other side, that you're not going to negotiate, that you're not going to take their offers to talk at all, then when you put all your efforts into a military solution and it fails, then you have no solution. And I've taken part in a couple of Afghan simulations where we attempt negotiations. And what we come to every time is the fact that the Taliban now, because they're in such a position, are able to walk away from the negotiation table whenever they want. Because we already played our hand, because we already went with a military-first approach and it failed. And also, too, in clear indications that it was going to fail. There was nothing I saw in 2009 that led me or and most other people believe that military expansion of the war in Afghanistan was going to succeed. In fact, most of us expected that it was going to fail and be counterproductive. So I think that's the problem you now face, Francisco, that here we are in 2014 going into 2015. The war is still going on. No one is talking to anybody at any meaningful level in Afghanistan about negotiations, about settling the conflict, about achieving some kind of political order and some type of lasting peace. And so I think, unfortunately, what you're going to see now is you're going to see stalemates occur around the country where various sects, various factions, the government may control this city, the Taliban control this part over here, a warlord controls this over here, drug lords control this area. And I think that's the way it's gonna shake out. And so, again, the United States needs to learn from that experience that there are very real limits on our power. There are very real limits on what we're able to accomplish. And that if we only try military solutions, well, look at our history since the end of World War II. When has a military solution worked well for the United States in terms of achieving something lasting? Then you go from this, and I entirely agree with what you brought up about the state of the women, the fate of the average Afghan person. They continue to suffer. So I think it's a very difficult situation, but unfortunately the United States has put itself in a position where I feel there is nothing it can do except withdraw. And by withdrawing then, by pulling that support from the Afghan government, that forces the Afghan government to negotiate. And then hopefully maybe then you will see some form of settlement, but I don't think it's very likely.
Matthew Ho. We only have time for that part of our conversation. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest. Matthew Ho is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and former director of the Afghanistan Study Group. He writes on issues of war, peace, and post-traumatic stress disorder recovery at Matthew Ho, that's H-O-H, .com. Again, go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of our conversation. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.